From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Here's what's happening. Well, the top U.S. and NATO commander in Afghanistan has reported to President Barack Obama that without more troops, the U.S. risks failure in a war it's been waging since September of 2001. Resources will not win this war, but underscoring it could lose it, says General Stanley McChrystal. He wrote this in a five-page commander's summary. Now, his confidential 66-page report was sent to Defense Secretary Robert Gates on August 30th. It is now under review by the president. So it looks like they're going to send more troops there for sure. The infection that killed an Illinois scientist may be connected to bacteria that he researched that causes a plague. The University of Chicago Medical Center is making this report. The university said that its researchers studied the genetics of harmful bacteria, including Yersinia pestis, which causes the illness. Now, he died on September 13th. The medical center said the bacteria he worked with was a weakened strain and isn't known to cause illness in healthy adults. The strain was approved by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for laboratory studies. They say people with a genetic susceptibility to colon cancer could cut their chances of developing this disease in half by taking a daily dose of aspirin. The finding might lead to other treatments by helping researchers understand how aspirin combats colon cancer, one of the top three cancers in rich countries. Tax dodgers who hid assets overseas will get a few extra weeks to apply for an amnesty program that has been flooded with applications ahead of the Wednesday deadline. The Internal Revenue Service said the deadline will now be extended until October 15th. More than 3,000 Americans have applied for the program, which promises no jail time and reduced penalties for tax cheats who come forward. This, according to the government. A backlash is brewing on Capitol Hill against banks that charge large fees for overdrafts without asking or telling you, the customer. The latest sign that the financial crisis is shifting the balance of power from banks toward borrowers. Banks struggling to survive have become increasingly reliant on the fees, which total about $38.5 billion this year. But congressional Democrats who pushed through new restrictions on credit cards this spring now are promising to crack down on overdraft fees, using words like criminal and ripoff to describe the practice of letting people overspend and then charging them fees without warning. Most overdrafts are now incurred on debit card transactions, by the way. Surging floodwaters ripped apart a West Georgia trailer home, drowning a two-year-old boy, swept away from his father's arms. In Atlanta, stranded motorists scrambled to the tops of their cars as water rose on one of the city's busiest highways. To the north, crews furiously tried to shore up a levee, holding back a surging river. In the southeast, they were hit with big rain. So far, six people killed across the region. You know, the average person may not associate coolness with the sun. The sun releases energy through deep nuclear fusion reactions in its core and has surface temperatures as hot as 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. But it's not all that cool, they say sometimes. The sun's recent activity or lack thereof may be linked to the pleasant summer temperatures the Midwest has enjoyed this year, according to a head of a geological survey. The sun is at a low point of a deep solar minimum in which there are few to no sunspots on the surface. In July through August, 51 consecutive days passed without a spot, one day short of tying the record of 52 days from the early 1900s. During the last hour of our show tonight, Professor James McCanney joins us, and we'll talk with him about these sunspots. A couple soon expecting their seventh child has had their fifth and sixth taken by social workers after warnings that the family needed to slim down their overweight kids or risk losing custody. The unnamed 39-year-old mother from Scotland told the United Kingdom's The Sun newspaper, "This is every family's worst nightmare." Scotland's television station STV reports the family was warned last year that they risk losing all their kids ages 3 to 13 unless the children lost some weight. At the time, the youngest girl weighed 56 pounds. The oldest, a boy, has since grown to over 220 pounds. Our expert on privacy, Catherine Albrecht, with us. Catherine, now, this hasn't happened directly in this country yet, in the United States, but there have been some cases where social workers go in and try to take the kids.
Well, you know what makes this case particularly tragic, and you know this family in Dundee, Scotland, having their 3 and 4 year old children taken away from them. You know, it's not only tragic for the parents, but obviously it's tragic for those children to be ripped away from a loving family that cares about them. You know, the thing that I found most disturbing about this story is it was the parents themselves who approached the social workers and asked for some help, just with some basic child rearing sorts of questions. And I'll tell you, when you have 6 kids, ages 3 to 13, you probably need a little bit of help on occasion, and that nanny state government is always there reaching out. We want to help you. We're big sister. We're looking out for you. And it turns out that when you actually reach out to them and you ask for that kind of government assistance, that it can end up in a total nightmare. Here in the United States, obviously, I don't know of any cases where children have been taken away from their parents for obesity, but we are definitely moving in that direction of a nanny state and a government that says, hey, we want to help you. We're just looking out for your best interest. And we do know that that can backfire. You know, over in England, George, tying this in with the sort of thing that I look at, which is the growing surveillance society, in the UK, there are now 2,000 families, get this, that actually have government cameras installed in their homes, George Orwell style, literally watching how they raise their kids. So what's happening in the UK now, you're given a choice. We're either going to take your children away from you and you'll never see them again potentially, or you'll only have visitation with them as they grow up in someone else's home, or you can agree to allow us to install this camera, and we'll put one in your bedroom, we'll put one in your dining room, and one in your kitchen, and we'll make sure, and this is a quote, that the children attend school, go to bed on time, and eat proper meals with these cameras in your home. And, you know, faced with that kind of a decision where a parent has the option of losing their children altogether or putting up with the cameras, 2,000 families, and they look to expand it now to 20,000 families, are saying yes to this.
All right, Catherine, thank you so much. Catherine Albrecht, her websites will be linked up at our Twitter feed, coasttocoastam.com, right after the program. The world's hairiest man is to undergo plastic surgery after failing to win a part in a television drama. The 32-year-old man from China has 96% of his body covered with thick layers of black hair. 96%. He was confident of landing a leading role in the production of a Chinese classic called Journey to the West, which tells how a monkey helps his Buddhist master. He wanted to be the monkey. He said, I'm going to have surgery now to get rid of the hair and facial plastic surgery to make myself look more like a pretty monkey. And he says the director of the film will regret this decision. Huh. How has the past life recall as a child led this person to seek physical evidence for visions of temples, pyramids, and ceremonies? In a moment, Dr. Carmen Bolter joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Our main guest tonight, Dr. Carmen Bolter, is a professor at the University of Calgary, teaching in the Graduate Division of Educational Research. Carmen has been to 51 different countries to search for clues of lost matriarchal cultures from a golden age. Now, her quest has brought her to Egypt 23 times, where she has done extensive academic research and field work in the pyramid fields around the Great Pyramid. She has recently completed a groundbreaking documentary series called The Pyramid Code. We're going to be talking with her about her discoveries tonight. Here she is, Carmen Bolter. Carmen, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks, George.
Good. It's good to have you on the program. 23 times in Egypt.
Yeah.
That's amazing. You know, my father was born there. He's born in Cairo.
That's right.
He's not been back since. Tell me, why 23 trips, Carmen?
Well, I've just had so much research to do, and one thing led to another. One research discovery brought on more field work, and I really had a lot of exploring to do. So,
this has been a lifelong quest for you, hasn't it?
It certainly has.
Did you feel a calling when you were smaller?
Oh, absolutely. I started having past life recall when I was 6 years old, and I saw the headdresses and the necklaces on my cousin, actually, and I kind of brushed it away, and then it came back again, and I realized it probably wasn't a good idea to tell anyone. And then when I was 11 years old, I started looking through my father's books, and I found one on Edgar Cayce and another one that had pictures of the inside of the Great Pyramid and around the Sphinx. And I just had this impulse inside me, like, how close can you get to it? And I decided I wanted to go right away, or as soon as I could. And so I asked my mother where Egypt was, and she said, well, look it up in the Atlas. And I looked it up, and I said, how do you get there? And she said, well, call the airlines. So I was making 25 cents an hour, and I found out the tickets were $1,400. And so I started calculating, and I was determined to get there the whole time. And I ended up going for the first time when I was 22. And a lot of things happened there that planted the seeds that just kept me going back.
Now you must have frequent flyer miles. You've got to, huh? That's a lot of, you know what's so remarkable, Carmen, is these events that affect us when we're children, because I went through some similar things, stay with us as we're adults. They form our careers and our paths, don't they?
Absolutely.
Truly amazing. Truly. Now, when you went to Egypt, whether it was the one time or the 23rd time, did you have help and assistance, or did you just go off on your own?
Oh, I was taken under the wing of a few different families. The first time I went, I was on a 14-month trip around the world, and I actually ended up meeting some people who invited me to come and stay with their family. And one of the young gentlemen, one of the sons, ended up taking me to the Great Pyramid, and he showed me how you can stay in there all afternoon, because in those days, you used to go in on the hour every hour, and tourists would stay in there for 10 minutes, and he said, if you just stay back, we can stay in here, and the next group that comes up, we'll hear them, we'll join in, look around, and we ended up staying in the Great Pyramid for 3.5 hours, and I took quite a few pictures, and there were apparitions and anomalies in the pictures. So I took my camera to a camera store and asked what was wrong with it, and they said, nothing.
So nothing.
And so all of a sudden I realized that my camera was picking up on energy fields inside there. And in subsequent trips, I ended up meeting the Fayed family, and they're connected to Dodi Fayed, Princess Diana's Dodi. And at the end of the British occupancy, all the land around the Giza Plateau was given to their grandfather. And so over the years, they really helped me a lot. They had property close into the plateau. Have you ever heard of the Champion?
I've not heard of the Champion, but the Fayed family, I think, did try to get us to Egypt a few years ago. Tell me about the Champion.
Okay, well, he was in charge of the plateau in the olden days when Zahi Hawass was a junior archaeologist who
okay.
just had a bachelor's degree. And he was called the Champion because he used to run up the pyramid in 4 minutes and down in three. Now, I've climbed the pyramid a couple of times, and it takes about 45 minutes to get up there. It's really quite the climb. And so he and his sons, again, actually, helped me do some things. And Champion had the keys to the pyramid at some point, and then over the years, Zahi Hawass got more and more power and more control. And but anyway, it was the Champion. One day he summoned me, and he sent a little boy to get me to come for tea the next day. And I went, and he said, I'm going to take you to to Zahi. And I said, okay, and I didn't know what he was going to say. And he was very, very old at this time.
Yeah, and was he Egyptian, Champion?
Oh, definitely, definitely. He's a Fayed.
Okay, all right.
Hefnawi Fayed.
Okay.
And so we got there, and I was, very curious about being in the Department of Antiquities and meeting Zahi and all of that. But I really didn't know what our purpose was or why he felt so determined to bring me there. And so Zahi says, what do you want? And he says, well, you know who I was to you. I was your boss, and now you're in charge of everything. And it won't be long before I pass, and I have something, a favor to ask of you. And Zahi said, what? And Champion said, well, anything she asks you, I want you to say yes. And so that led to years of Zahi honoring that and saying yes to me when I asked for permission to do certain things. So,
and let me tell you, Carmen, that is a benefit that you just can't find anywhere.
That's right.
I mean, because he is tough. We've had him on the program before.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know how he believes that everything's Egyptian, regardless of the theories we've all had, mm-hmm. everything's Egyptian. And he doesn't, he's so focused on that, he doesn't want to hear anything outside of that.
Well, he asked me if I was a New Ager and, you know, what my profile was and all of that. But he did honor it, and I feel really good about it.
Well, we're going to get your take on how you think the pyramids were built. Now, tell me about your research when you were in Egypt. How did you do it?
Okay. Well, I started out with the Canadian Embassy in Cairo and the Egyptian Embassy in Ottawa. And I had written a manuscript, a second one after my book, Angels and Archetypes, or I was in the process of writing it. And I wanted to go into the archives of the National Museum, and the Cairo University Faculty of Archaeology Rare Books Library, and then the American University of Cairo Library. And so it was a lot of paperwork, and I finally got in there. And when I was walking around on Cairo University campus, of course, I was the only woman who didn't have my hair covered, but I spent a whole summer because of all the Islamic energy and everything. But I spent a whole summer being allowed to go into this rare books library, and it had all of the field notes of anyone who had ever done research on the Giza Plateau. So the books were in German, French, English, and Arabic. Of course, there was no filing system. There were just women who would bring me tea and piles of books and put them on the table, and those big fans going because it was in the summer, and the pages were dark brown because they had, you know, been there because they're so old.
Yeah.
And I just started taking notes, and I found all kinds of interesting things in there. And then they had to take records of how many barrels of sand had been removed and how many children and people had worked on the plateau in any given day, and actually what they found. And so even in the National Museum archives, there were some interesting things. And, of course, you have to be an archaeology student usually to get in there, or some kind of researcher. So it was very good to start or to do that part with the book research. But then later, I wanted to do more field work and spend a lot of time on the Giza Plateau. And it wasn't very interesting to me to be there when the public was there. So I always wanted to go on the plateau after it closed. And so I'd spend up to 4 months in Egypt at a time and go on the plateau every night when it closed. And so that's how I started to gather a lot of the data.
When you're standing next to the Great Pyramid, maybe on the outside looking up it as far as you could see, what's it like? What's the feeling?
Well, first of all, it's huge. It's 2.3 million stones, and it covers several acres. And so however you see it from a picture, you know, we're about two stones high.
Yeah.
You know, the rest of it's there. But what's also interesting is that when you're standing close to it, if you look across the sides of it, it's actually concave. And I'm told that if it had been flat, it would look like it was inflated somehow. And so it's fascinating. It's kind of like the columns in Greece, where the architecture of them is actually an optical illusion.
So they even understood that.
Oh, there's so much they understood. And in investigations now, and looking at Starry Night Pro and typing in various planets and stuff, that they knew a lot. And I'm still fascinated with how they put it together. I mean, you know, I just had a deck put in, and you know, the stones, just on a 280-square-foot paving stones, everything's crooked. And when you think, we can't build anything square today.
Yeah.
And when you think how precise it is, it's mind-boggling. And you can't put a razor blade between the stones. I mean, it's incredible.
Do you think they had high technology?
Absolutely. And yeah. The evidence of it, it's everywhere, but we're not looking for it because we're not used to things made out of stone being high technology. And we're taught that we're the smartest that we've ever been and we're the most evolved, and we call it the myth of progress and the Darwinian delusion. And so when we look at anything Egyptian, we go along with the story that they built it with chisels and that sort of thing, and slaves pulling stuff along on rope with ropes and on logs. And it's not even plausible that that's what happened.
Has Zahi argued with you about some of your thoughts and theories?
Well, actually, I've kept quite a low profile, and I haven't announced to him what I was doing, and no, I haven't talked to him about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll probably hear about this one tonight.
Oh, God.
You ready? You ready for that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. There's been so much written about the Great Pyramid, so many different theories, yet nobody really understands. You know, I'll remove you for a moment. nobody really understands exactly what happened. Everybody has their own theories. I've heard poured theories to extraterrestrial theories to, you know, there was a movement from within the pyramid where they pushed the blocks. We'll talk more about this, Carmen, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Man, I've got another great announcement for Coast to Coast, folks. Let me tell you, we're happy to announce our newest feature, the Coast to Coast AM app. Now, it's free to all users of the iPhone and the iPod Touch. This is an exciting new way for you to stay in touch, as well as for Streamlink subscribers to get show audio directly from their mobile device. This app features customized content from the website, such as upcoming shows, recaps, and articles. Plus, it includes just an addictively fun brand new game called Alien Abduction, created by one of our listeners, and it is incredible. For further details about this cool new app, visit Coast to Coast's homepage, and I think you'll have some fun. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, we're with Dr. Carmen Bolter as we talk about the pyramids of Egypt and some of her theories. Carmen, why, yourself excluded, are so many theories out there about these pyramids and how they were constructed? I mean, all kinds of theories. How come?
Well, I think we're really curious about what the pyramids are doing there. We don't have the technology to build them today, and they are an object of fascination. There's more books written about the pyramids and Atlantis than probably any other subject known, and so we want to get to the bottom of it. But I think that the reason that we can't get to the bottom of it is we're looking at it through our own cultural lenses, through patriarchal ways of being and thinking that want to divide and conquer. And we also, you know, have the tendency to want to be right. And so, you know, if we say it's a poured theory, then we want, okay, we'll give all the reasons why that's true. But I think the problem is we're not looking at it in a larger context. Like, how did the pyramid fields work with one another? We get focused on the Great Pyramid, which is really important. But did you know that there's 6 pyramid sites with 22 pyramids, north and south, within a 12-mile distance of the Great Pyramid? Well, why? And Robert Bovall's talked to us about how the 3 pyramids of Giza are aligned to the Belt of Orion. Well, is that all? Is it a unified theory of more stars being connected? And the other thing is that we're told that the pyramids were built in 2450 BC. Maybe that was a time when they did the last restoration on it, but there perhaps was a lot of work done before that, and they were built in far more ancient times. But we're told the Bible tries to insist that we're 6,000 years old, and it's not a popular thing to look further back, and there's reasons for that. So I think it's important not to get bogged down with little details and look at the details as well. But I also think that it will help us understand what's going on and why if we look at it from a bigger perspective.
You said earlier that Edgar Cayce had a great influence on you when you were younger. Did you study at all his discussions of a hall of records by the base of the Sphinx while you were in Egypt these 23 some times, Carmen?
Absolutely. In fact, I had a center there, where a guest house, and I called it the Hall of Records Retreat Center. So it's very important. But again, we think, you know, a lot of people think they're going to find a book written in English, you know, in a chamber.
That's right.
And it's just not like that. You know, it's the same thing as, you know, there's 4,000 Egyptian hieroglyphs in hieroglyphic writing, and there's 26 letters, and we say, okay, this glyph is an A, this glyph is a B. Well, it's a completely different linguistic system, and we want to take everything we see and shove it into the paradigm that we're familiar with. And for sure, the ancient Egyptians are a really good example of something that wasn't waiting for English and us to happen when it developed.
Now, did you find, because Zahi has not admitted this to me, anything that would show that there was a Hall of Records at the base of the Sphinx?
Yes, I would say. But it's going to be energetic and symbolic and not as concrete in the way. I think we found it, yes. I think the energetic signature is out. And also, when you say at the foot of the Sphinx, and we're talking underground, there's a network of underground passageways, And I think that that is one of the best kept secrets. And that has something to do with why that wall went up. There's a 20-mile or all the way around the Giza Plateau wall that cost them millions and millions of dollars. I think they locked the door after the horse was stolen, to tell you the truth. But they really didn't want people to find out what was going on under there. And there's a lot of facts in the documentary series, The Pyramid Code, that have been verifiable and articles written and that sort of thing. But you're not going to find very much about what is actually underneath the Sphinx. Now, a lot of the field work that I did had to do with going inside the body of the Sphinx. And the watchmen were letting me go in there. And one time they opened the gate and they let me go in there all by myself. And for sure, it's a magnifier of energy. And even with a watchman standing there, you get the energy of his consciousness magnified as well. So it was really quite an experience to spend so much time largely alone and then totally alone, because there's various cavities. There's the inner chamber of the heart of the Sphinx, and there's different cavities that go on the left back rump of the Sphinx. It's a very narrow hole now, but I've been inside there, and there's all kinds of spiral chambers. But there's also old pictures, and this is what I ended up getting access to in the archives that I talked about in the last segment, of temples that were below the level of the legs of the Sphinx, like what it would be standing on. There's an old temple of Isis down there, and many, many passages. Well, the Department of Antiquities just cemented over the top of the whole thing and paved it. They're putting walls around it. Like, it's either they're in complete denial of the importance and even the fact that it's there, or they're really trying to cover something up. Now, I don't think we're going to get inside their minds about what they're actually doing, what they're hiding, or why. But that doesn't mean there isn't a whole network of passageways down there, because I spent 5 years in and out of holes. And, of course, over the centuries, they've been blocked. Lots of little passageways that go a certain way, but then you can see that it's been blocked recently. But go ahead.
Well, how do we know that the Egyptians haven't already been down there and that they pulled things out and they're hiding them somewhere?
Well, that's a tempting thought.
Yes, it is.
But the thing, I think we're focused on a thing.
Yes, I expect... flying machines down there, Carmen, or tablets explaining the origin of life and things like that. That's what I expect.
Okay, but when we say tablets explaining the origins of life, we have that on the fresco walls, but we're not deciphering how they're talking about biology and cosmology. The Egyptians were very focused on how we got here and what happened after we left. They had no word for death, and they understood string theory, quantum physics, all of it, biomechanics, all of it. And we see that hidden in plain sight on the frescoes. Now, the other thing is that there was a lot of information that was drowned when the Aswan Dam flooded. There were 18 temples that were under the water. They knew Abu Simbel was going to go underwater. Then later the Temple of Isis would go three-quarters of the way underwater every time the Nile flooded. But there were 16 other temples that ended up completely submerged. And all the Nubian villages and people who had ancient wisdom, because they don't have a written language, they have a verbal language, they all had to move. But now UNESCO has had time to one by one get those temples out. And recently I was able to go on a cruise on the Aswan, behind the Aswan Dam, and visit some of these temples. And I've studied a lot of the frescoes that are in other temples, and there were some surprises there. There were some secrets that I hadn't seen before.
Such as?
The Pharaoh inside the world tree, lots and lots of references to sacred cows, the sacred feminine, cattle cults, and that has to do with star maps and the Big Dipper and Hathor, but the connection to the Blue Lotus, and I can speak about those symbols a little later, but the point is you're saying you expect to find tablets. Well, there are tablets, some underground, some above ground. But a lot of the stuff that's in the passageways and inside the Great Pyramid aren't decorated, okay? And Chris Dunn talked about it being a machine. I'm very much into the idea that it was a huge system that functioned all together. Now, 3 years ago, you had William Henry on. I think it's ironic that he's going to be on tomorrow night.
Yes.
And he asked the question, if anybody knows how all of this worked together, I'd love it if they contacted me. And I just, you know, felt all kinds of energy come up about that, because that's the point. So just like we wouldn't put a decoration inside our oven, a lot of these passageways underneath aren't likely to have the tablets, okay? Full stop. When you said flying machines and spaceships, there was a lintel that fell off recently off a temple of above at the Temple of Abydos.
I've seen that tablet. If that's the same one you're talking about,
I think
incredible.
It's incredible, but think about it. There was something put over the top of it that then had more recent hieroglyphics. So what this lends itself to is the idea that we need to look at dynastic Egypt from 3113 BC until it ended in Cleopatra's time as the patriarchal part of Egypt. And then there were matriarchal cultures all over the world, and this is the subject matter of my book. I did many, many years of research on that. And so we have to look at epochs of time that go farther and farther and farther back. So if we tend to think because ancient Egypt is the most ancient that we tend to know about, that we talk about, but the part that we're looking at is the recent part of Egypt. So they had different stages of corruption and less spirituality, and, mm-hmm. and you understand what I'm saying.
Sure.
And so in order to understand this story, I think we need to establish a much, much longer timeline. So having said that, when you look in Abydos, the Egyptians themselves had covered up those flying machines, and then you've got people saying that they were hieroglyphic embedded on top of another one, and they were various kings' inscriptions. Well, really, that's not what they look like. You know what they look like. They look like a helicopter. They look
like
flying machines.
Submarines, everything.
Okay, so you're right that the flying machines, the secrets of biology and how we got here, the star maps and all of that were within the secrets of the Egyptians. But it's not hidden in the oven. It's hidden in plain sight.
Right.
And what's underneath is another secret.
Carmen, does this tell you that there was an ET visitation or a number of visitations from above?
Well, you know Graham Hancock.
Uh-huh.
In his book Supernatural, he says we don't need extraterrestrials to explain any of this. We need interterrestrials. Okay, he talks about the altered states of consciousness that led to visions, and he talks about perianthropes, which are half animal and half human. Well, when we put the spin on it, we say the Egyptians were obsessed with death and they worshipped animals, but that's not what we're looking at. Okay, so. I mean, it's a big question, and I'm not willing to step out and say they were or they weren't here in visitations. Like, and you've had enough to do with UFOs to say, well, they are here, and some people have seen them. And when you're lying in your bed and you've been abducted, maybe you had an inner journey and you came back with scars. I mean, we get confused inside at the semantics of what we're talking about. I think that when they talk about conversations with the elders or the wise ones, they talk about connections to Sirius and Osiris, and that has to do with Orion and Isis and all of that. I got those backwards, but you know what I mean. Isis and Osiris representing Sirius and Orion. To what extent? And we talk about channeled work and, you know, remote viewing and all of that. So there's a way to paint this picture where something that is outside of three-dimensional physical reality can exist if we expand our consciousness. Okay, but we've got a big taboo about that sort of thing.
Sure do.
And the go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that the Egyptians obviously cultivated altered states of consciousness deliberately, and they learned how to navigate the bardos. So when it came time for death, they didn't get all surprised. They knew how to consciously go. So weaving all of this into the way they lived, they also knew how to depart. And so there's... what I'm trying to do here is explain it in a way where we can understand them, but they were well versed in out of body experiences and consciousness.
Do you believe that the way the Egyptians handled death, though they never really talked about death per se, convinces us today that there is a hereafter?
Absolutely. Well, when you go into the Valley of the Kings, the inscriptions on the walls that no one's allowed to take pictures of are giving the map of the Bardos. They're explaining what happens. Now, why they kept their organs and put them into perfume jars and the canopic jars and how they decorated their tombs wasn't the idea that they were going to reincarnate and go find their tomb and get their stuff. I mean, we think of them as misguided and infantile and kind of a little off, right? But there were reasons for this, because if the physical body was attended to, the old physical body was attended to, the ka, the spirit body, the ba, would be free to roam and choose a new incarnation at will. And so they weren't forced to come back unnecessarily. And, you know, you've talked about ghosts and all kinds of things where it's a lower level soul where things didn't end well and they're trapped. And that's not the same thing as a high level ascended master channeled being. You understand what I'm saying? And
sure.
So they were trying to allow themselves to navigate these other realms and then reincarnate in a way that would progress them in terms of levels of consciousness.
Did you come across anything that would have backed up the work of Zechariah Sitchin and his work with Sumerian tablets?
Well, yes, and I've met Sitchin. And now the thing is that there's, and again, Coast is a wonderful forum for exploring a lot of these things, and there are scholars since that have looked at little syntactical differences in the way that Zechariah Sitchin interpreted grammar in the Sumerian text that slightly change how it's interpreted. But he was basically talking about the wars of gods and men. And this is far out stuff. And hardly anybody has tackled what Sitchin has tackled. And it seems to float in its own little pocket. You understand what I mean by that, I'm sure. That how do we take the idea of the Nephilim and reptilian race and, you know, the wars of gods and men out there and how it affected us here? Well, personally, and it fits into the visions I've had as well, let's imagine that the Golden Age was in full swing. We're in, how the processional cycle works, every 13,000 years. So we're in the deepest, densest, darkest, ready to turn the corner back up into the next Golden Age. So every 13,000 years, we go down, and 13,000, we go up. And then 26,000 years added to that, so 39,000 years ago, we would have been at a peak Golden Age. And so let's imagine we were in full swing, and the energy machines were working, and people had high levels of consciousness and senses of peace and all of that. And then something happens, and we're taken over by a darker force that overcharges the machines. And like if you go into the Great Pyramid and the Pyramids of Dahshure, you'll see these incredible cracks inside, and it would have taken a huge force. Well, I don't think if everything was going along as it should in the Golden Age, the interruption would have happened in a way that would have destroyed or hurt, not completely destroyed, but damaged the energy system. And so, yes, I think that something happened that was evil, if you will, that affected something that probably was quite peaceful. Now, if I was going to describe that, I would probably not make a documentary series, but I would make a feature film that was more speculative, and we would paint a story that seemed more like a fantasy, because we can't prove that, right?
Oh, I want to get into your pyramid code when we come back at the top of the hour, Carmen, and some of the other work that you've been doing. This has been a lifelong effort for you, hasn't it?
It sure has.
No end in sight?
Oh, actually, you know what? I feel pretty satisfied now. Now that it's all on DVD and tidy little packages and edited, I feel quite complete, to tell you the truth.
Finally.
Yeah.
All right. Well, stay with us. We're going to be back with Dr. Carmen Bolter in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Her website, pyramidcode.com.